Coming up on Weekend America.
Sarah had always congratulated herself for raising a Buddha baby.
I had to come face to face with this idea that maybe my awesome parenting wasn't the reason he was a Buddha, and maybe I suck as a parent now because my kid's sick.
On this Mother's Day weekend, we'll hear Sarah's story and your favorite memories of motherhood. I'm Bill Radke. Also this hour, Edmundo used to go out on the weekends. What does he do now?
Nothing. Probably stay home watching the TV with my niece, and that's it.
A crackdown on illegal immigration changes the weekend culture in Nashville. And the space shuttle wakes up to public radio.
Thanks very much to my wonderful wife, Jennifer, for a little powder milk biscuit to wake up to in the morning. No better way to start it than a nice wake up like that. Thanks very much.
Well, if your family's tried them powder milk.
Listen in to astronauts starting their day after the news.
If your family's tried them all, you know you're sad.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. Desiree Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke. This weekend, moms get in free at concerts and other events across the country. We ask you about the best Mother's Day gift you ever got, and we'll share your terrific stories later this hour. By the way, you don't have to take mom jello wrestling this weekend, but you could. In Manhattan, you're going to find out why a normal-seeming someone steps into a gelatinous ring in a few minutes. Besides jello, what makes good ammunition in a food fight?
You know, I've always been partial to dumplings.
I would have to say pudding.
Baby tomatoes would be awesome.
Brussels sprouts with gravy.
At first I thought mashed potatoes, but no, you'd want au gratin potatoes because it'd keep the heat well and it sticks to things.
Well, this would probably hurt someone, but an orange, because, you know, it's real easy to throw like a baseball and you could really bean someone in the head. But in case you don't want to do that, because that might be lethal, a milkshake, because, you know, that kind of, you know, pours easy. And if you got a cup, you can really chuck it really far.
So an orange is dangerous, but a flying shake-filled cup is a pacifist move. Those voices came to us from Fairbanks, Alaska, St. Louis, and Charleston, West Virginia. Well, this is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend. Weekends are not what they used to be in Nashville, Tennessee, not for a certain part of the population. There was a time when immigration enforcement was a job for the feds. But lately, local police departments that don't think Washington is doing enough have been taking matters into their own hands. 1 year ago, Nashville's Sheriff's Department gave its officers the right to detain undocumented immigrants. Nashville was one of the first in the country to do that, and many towns have followed. Reporter Daniela Gerson looks at how this policy is changing weekends in Music City.
It's Friday night, and Edmundo enters the International Hair Salon with a pocket full of cash. For reasons that will become clear, Edmundo didn't want his last name used. The Mexican immigrant came to Nashville 2 years ago, got a job installing air conditioners, and joined the enormous foreign influx that transformed the city. When Edmundo is ready to party, he doesn't head to any honky-tonk country bars or bluegrass hoedowns. For the single and handsome Edmundo, Friday nights have meant hitting a salsa club.
Well, you know, just get ready, change your clothes, go and hang out with your friends. Go and dance with a bunch of bars right here in Nashville, Coco Loco, or three or four nightclubs, or you can go dance and, you know, drink something.
Edmundo reclines in his favorite barber's chair as a single blade scrapes down his throat. He likes to come here after work to get a shave and a haircut before the weekend's festivities get started. So what are his plans?
Nothing. Probably stay home watching the TV with my niece, and that's it.
So that sounds pretty boring.
Yeah, it sounds pretty boring.
And why are you doing that?
Because I don't have a driver's license, and I don't want to put myself, you know, in trouble. So
Edmundo doesn't have a driver's license because he's an illegal immigrant. It used to be that Tennessee was far enough from the border that nobody worried too much about immigration status. Not anymore. Just over a year ago, the Davidson County Sheriff entered into a new agreement with the Department of Homeland Security. It enabled local deputies to identify and process arrested immigrants. The results have been dramatic. Arrests flagged for immigration violations have shot up 20-fold, from 150 to nearly 3,000 a year. Sheriff Darren Hall says the program is highly popular, and hundreds of colleagues from around the country have called him requesting advice.
But the point is, the public at large, I believe, don't like the fact that people continue to violate the law and are in our country illegally. I mean, that's been shown in, I don't know, just about any conversation you would have. Now, how and where that line needs to be, I understand there's a debate about that, but I don't think there's a debate about it.
There's even debate within the police force. On Friday evening, Officer Richard Bain sits in his police car, patrolling the immigrant neighborhood of small family homes bordering the barber shop. An 18-year veteran of the force, Bain refuses to speak in the microphone, but he has a lot to report. Illegals are fleeing the scene of car accidents. They're not willing to cooperate when he comes to investigate, and victims are afraid to report abuse. In Bain's opinion, he could do his job better if immigration was left to the feds. A few hours later, it's well into the evening at one of Edmundo's favorite salsa clubs, Coco Loco. A festive palm tree sways over the bar. A full band is up on stage trying to rally the club's Hispanic patrons with a dose of national pride. But it's having little success. Venezuela! Ecuador! The club is half empty, and the crowd is on the paler end of the spectrum. Santos Gonzalez, a Puerto Rican transplant from New York to Nashville, says business is awful. What's missing? Hispanics.
Oh, a lot of people, there's no doubt. We have lost 40% of our business. We're really...
Gonzalez speaks to me outside of the club, watching the trickle of patrons enter the door.
Yes, I think they're afraid to come out pretty much every night. Every night. They are. They're afraid to come out. I've heard that people are just going to work, and they're not even going out to the restaurants. They're going out to...
Gonzalez is struggling to keep his business open, and he's not the only one. The Nashville Area Hispanic Chamber of Commerce reports that Latino nightclubs and restaurants across the city are staying open fewer hours, taking items off the menu, and laying people off. In Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Daniela Gerson for Weekend America.
This weekend in Nashville, the Cielo nightclub is advertising Celebre el Día de las Madres, Celebrate Mother's Day, with salsa group Jay Franco and his orchestra. The ad says 18+, ID, no insista, no exceptions. Who knows what turnout will be like? You're listening to Weekend America. This weekend, America's best young wrestlers are in Waterloo, Iowa, competing in qualifying events for the Olympic trials. This is happening across the country, athletes in the various sports trying for the Beijing Games. As the Games approach, though, some human rights activists are calling on the U.S. to boycott. And whatever the arguments, pro and con, that would change these athletes' lives forever. When the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Olympics in 1980, the best hurdler in the world was a young American named Ronaldo Nehemiah.
Nehemiah away beautifully at the moment. So is Foster. Foster ahead at the moment. Foster from Nehemiah. Greg Foster. Nehemiah coming back. Now Nehemiah. Nehemiah from Foster. Nehemiah first. Foster second. And Santana third. 12.92.
Ronaldo Nehemiah breaking the 13-second mark for the first time ever. He was going to be an Olympic champion for sure. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper spoke with Nehemiah recently about the hurdle he couldn't get over.
So I want to take you back to 1980. You're training to participate in the Olympics, and then all of a sudden you hear you're not going.
I have given notice that the United States will not attend the Moscow Olympics unless the Soviet invasion forces are withdrawn from Afghanistan before February 20th. That deadline is tomorrow, and it will not be changed.
What was that moment like for you?
Well, when the definitive word came down from President Carter that we weren't going, it was that of devastation. I was 21 years of age, just scratching the surface of my athletic career. And my perspective, I guess, is that I was still young enough to have other opportunities at Olympic Games, although I also had enough awareness and insight that there would be retaliation, which there was. In 1984, we were the host country in Los Angeles, and various countries boycotted our games. So we obviously didn't have the world's finest athletes competing in what was deemed an American Olympic Games.
Did you participate in the 84 Games in Los Angeles?
I did not participate in the 84 Games. And prior to that, I struggled for about a year and a half after the boycott, trying to make sense of it, trying to understand it, and trying to put it in perspective of what it could mean to me. And I wasn't willing at that time to spend four more additional years training for what I knew was on the horizon.
I understand that people will occasionally introduce you as an Olympic gold medalist. How do you respond to that?
For a while there, while it was very painful, for about 15, 18 years, I would just, you know, let it go and not say anything. It struck a chord in me, which I didn't like, but I didn't want to embarrass a person who may not have had all their facts right. Obviously, they didn't. Probably in the last 7 to 8 years, I'm far more comfortable with letting anyone know politely that, you know, for the record, I didn't.
What happened in the last 7 or 8 years that made you be able to come to grips with that?
What has happened is that you find out what most people think about you when they no longer have to cheer for you. And I have had the good fortune to have so many positives continue to be said about me, compliments bestowed on me, many years removed from the sport. I think I performed at the best time that one could have ever performed during the amateur era, because I did it for the love of the sport. I didn't do it for any monetary gain, because there wasn't any. And, you know, I'm gratified in knowing that I didn't have to win an Olympic medal to feel this proud and this satisfied with all that I did without going to the Olympic Games.
You're now a sports agent. How did not going to the Olympics, how is that affecting how you deal with your clients?
Even if we had gone to the Olympic Games, anything could have happened on that day. I could have clipped a hurdle, got out of the blocks, you know, awkwardly. 2004, the Athens Olympics, a client of mine still today, Perdita Felician, was coming out of college, University of Illinois. She was the favorite to win the gold medal in Athens, and the gun goes off in the finals, and she hits the first hurdle and falls.
Wow.
And I call it a coming to Jesus talk with her. I just looked her right in the eye, and I told her my experience in 1980, and that, you know, I would be disappointed if you would have let this one race and this failure in this one race wash away so much of what she had accomplished. It's not about one race.
Well, thanks again for spending your time with us this weekend.
I really appreciate it, Desiree. Thank you so much.
Ronaldo Nehemiah speaking with Weekend America's Desiree Cooper. His client, Perdita Felician, suffered a foot sprain in February. She's still questionable for the Beijing Olympics.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Guilt and motherhood seem to go hand in hand, especially when your child is sick and you didn't see it. That's next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Our show is about what America is doing this weekend, like, oh, I don't know, celebrating mothers with cards and flowers and burnt toast and dry waffles. No matter how runny we make those eggs, we can never thank Mom enough for all she went through for us. Reporter Rob McGinley Myers brings us an example now, a mom who thought everything was going so smoothly.
Sarah McGinley didn't want to be one of those hovering, nervous mothers. She believed in letting kids take chances, letting them get dirty, letting them eat food off the floor. And her parenting style seemed to be working. Her son Elliot was the most well-behaved 2-year-old her friends had ever met. Sarah's my wife's sister, so I know Elliot, and I remember thinking he'd grow up to be a monk or something. He appeared so calm and at peace with the world.
I used to call him like my Buddha boy, because that's what he was like. And I thought that said something about my spiritual grounding, that I would give birth to a Buddha. God, that's embarrassing but true.
But when he was 2.5, Elliot traded in his Buddha-like calm for nonstop whining and crying. Sarah took him to the clinic, even though he didn't have any other symptoms. She was afraid the doctor would roll his eyes at her, just another worried parent. Instead, the doctor told her to get to the hospital as soon as possible. It turned out Elliot had leukemia, a cancer that was clogging his veins with the wrong blood cells. She'll never forget when he got his first blood transfusion.
And it was literally like when you have a philodendron plant that is just completely wilted, and you water it, and you can practically watch the plant perk up. That is what it was like.
Later that day, with his brand new blood, Elliot danced to a song on TV. He played peekaboo with a stranger. He interrupted adult conversations. All things he had never done before. Sarah didn't even recognize him.
I had to come face to face with this idea that maybe my awesome parenting wasn't the reason he was a Buddha, and maybe I suck as a parent now because my kid's sick.
The extraordinarily calm child she'd known for 2 years had probably been sick for a long time, and Sarah had completely missed it. They brought Elliot home from the hospital 2 weeks later, and Sarah's husband had to go back to his job as an Episcopal priest. He worked about 80 hours a week, so Sarah was left at home, consumed with worry about drug dosages, side effects, germs. She'd once taken an almost political stance against hand sanitizer, but now she asked people to sanitize their hands at the front door. And she began calling the doctor every day.
I'd call if he coughed. I'd call if his forehead felt warm, even though the thermometer said his temperature was normal.
She was becoming exactly the paranoid mother she never wanted to be.
I'd call if he felt cold. I'd call if he said something hurt. I mean, I've just felt like completely inept, completely clueless, and completely paranoid.
She watched as Elliot was put on steroids for 3 weeks, and her slender, quiet child became a chubby, desperately hungry basket case. He would wake up screaming for hot dogs or pasta multiple times a night, and he demanded that his food be served with exactly the right dish and exactly the right utensil.
He would literally scream if it wasn't the way he wanted it. And I was so tired, I wasn't going to tell him, just eat that food however you want it. I knew he was on steroids. They warned us that it would make him crazy, that he would be irrational. And so I fed his every whim.
She fed his every whim in part because, in her darkest moments, she blamed herself for his illness.
Oh my gosh, maybe all that time I spent on my laptop, with my laptop on my lap when I was pregnant with Elliot, gave him leukemia. Oh my God, how many hours did I do that? I gave my kid cancer. How many times did I stand in front of the microwave when I was pregnant with Elliot? That might have for sure given him cancer.
Even as Sarah worried about what she might have done wrong in the past, she still had to prepare him for the future. The doctors had told her that Elliot was likely to survive this, and she couldn't just pamper him and give him everything he wanted. She had to continue to provide structure and discipline, or she might spoil him for life.
And it felt impossible for me at that time, in my state of exhaustion and shock, with me trying to balance how to be a quote-unquote good mom in this situation, how to raise this kid to grow up and function in the world, when all my rules had been, all the expectations had changed, all the rules seemed different.
But Sarah had to get used to the new rules and the new routines. She had to take Elliot in for his chemo sessions and his spinal taps.
They would take his blood, just see what his blood counts were, and then they would put him to sleep.
All right, Elliot. Here comes your little nap. You can just lean on Mom. Is that for Mom?
And they do this procedure where they put chemotherapy in his spinal fluid. Then we'd come back in and we'd have to keep him laying down for a half an hour, I think.
He's just sleeping off the drugs here. I was just looking at him. He's incredibly peaceful. And I haven't seen him, until all this was happening, I hadn't watched him sleep in a long time. And he's very sweet.
Hi. We're at the hospital.
You had a little nap?
Oh. Okay, we'll move this and you can sit right in my lap.
Elliot's treatment was organized into distinct stages, and the doctors had assured Sarah from the beginning that...
that it would keep getting easier. And I remember thinking in the hospital, if it doesn't get easier soon, I'm going to fall apart. And then it did get easier.
And it kept getting easier as they approached the final stage of treatment, known as maintenance. No more hospital visits or spinal taps, just low dosages of medication. For Sarah, it seemed like a return to the normal struggles of typical parenthood. They went in for one last checkup before maintenance started, and that day Sarah watched as Elliot played in the waiting room. For months, she'd been suffering through paranoia and guilt for everything that had gone wrong or might go wrong. But that day, in the waiting room, she could finally see her son, apart from her responsibility for him. She could just let him be a silly kid. He was playing with a Mr. Potato Head, and she took a picture of him to make sure she always remembered that moment.
Here we have my bald son. Our bald son and Mr. Potato Head, who actually had a leg coming out of his ear, if I remember correctly. And that day we made it to maintenance. We're going to make it. We're okay.
In St. Paul, I'm Rob McGinley Myers for Weekend America.
Sarah's son Elliot is now in full remission and has a full head of brown hair. This Mother's Day weekend, Elliot and his mom are planting ferns in their backyard. You can see Elliot before and after treatment at our website, weekendamerica.org. Seeing him just draws you into this story even more. It's a tough one whether you are a parent or not. And there's something else that can add to a parent's burden in a situation like Sarah's, and that is the effect that a child's illness can have on that child's siblings. Researchers say that healthy kids with a very ill brother or sister are more likely to show symptoms of anxiety and depression than other children. Now, on the positive side, some people say their experience with a sick or disabled sibling has given them a maturity and a perspective that other people don't have. At our website, you will find a link to the University of Michigan Health System. They have resources for parents and kids in this position. You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Coming up, this weekend's memories of the best Mother's Day gift ever and... Jell-O Wrestling. Covering it all, this is Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This is the show that asks you for the soundtrack to your weekend. When you want to get into a space that's all your own, what song do you keep going back to? Your answers have made for fantastic stories and a formidable mixtape. If you go to weekendamerica.org, you can capture the range of weekend soundtracks there. Our latest story comes from Sarah Quigley. Sarah listens to us in Morning Sun, Iowa. She told us the soundtrack to her weekend is the Bright Eyes song, We Are Nowhere, and It's Now.
Swear that there's no truth, and who cares? How come you say it like you're right? Why are you scared to dream of God when it's salvation that you want?
Nowhere and Now. Sarah, why is this your weekend soundtrack?
I have been displaced since graduating from the seminary. And I have ended up in rural Iowa while I wait to be appointed a call or given a church, as it is, as a pastor. And so listening to this song really speaks to my feeling of being displaced, being nowhere.
Between a past and future town, we are nowhere, and it's now, we are nowhere. And it's now, in like a 10-minute dream in the passenger seat while the world was flying by.
How does this Bright Eyes song relate to your work as a pastor?
I don't listen to a lot of the Christian top 40. I listen to musicians like Bright Eyes, Elliot Smith, Amy Mann, people that sing about the issues of the world around us and not just the secluded world of the church, and certainly not the same people that you expect to see sitting in church pews on Sunday morning.
Side effects they don't advertise. I've been sleeping so strange with a head full of pesticides.
The speaker's talking about the person who's drinking, who's punishing themselves, and it's very dystopic. You know, why are you continuing to hurt yourself and not live the promise that you could be living? But then later at the end of the song, he brings in this yellow bird, which is this promise, this hope, this brighter future. And since I feel really disconnected with my calling to be a pastor and kind of lost out here in rural America, I need that little yellow bird, that glimmer of hope. Faith, and more specifically for myself, Christianity, has a gift to give to the world. We can be melodic, we can dance, we can mosh, we can do all of these things, but we don't have to kill ourselves doing it. It should be a sign of our freedom as children of God versus the culture of drugs and violence.
Yellow bird, oh, how could you forget your yellow bird? And she took a small silver to me, she said, this one will bring you love. And I don't know if it's true, but I keep it for good luck.
Sarah, good luck with your ordination and being somewhere and now. Thank you for sharing your weekend soundtrack.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Sarah's weekend soundtrack is We Are Nowhere, and It's Now by Bright Eyes. What about you? In the soundtrack to your life, what plays when the weekend comes around? A song of recreation or the tune that was playing at a pivotal moment in your life? We'd like to hear about your song and your weekend. Play it for America. Get in touch with us at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Desiree Cooper is away, hopefully enjoying her Mother's Day weekend. For the past couple of weeks, we've been asking you, what is your best Mother's Day gift ever? A macaroni-encrusted picture frame you got in 1989? Or something you gave your wife on her first Mother's Day? Well, you told us some great stories.
Happy Mother's Day. This is Barb Schaller from Burnsville, Minnesota. One of the best Mother's Day gifts that I ever got was from my daughter, Becky, in 1999. It's a glass bowl. The bowl contains 75 colored strips of paper, rather like fortune cookie strips. And each piece of paper bears a memory or a recollection of a time that the two of us spent together. And each one starts out, "Do you remember when?" Like she said, "Do you remember when I got drunk during spring break and you didn't feel sorry that I had a hangover?" Or, "Do you remember when you told me oral sex didn't mean talking about sex?" Those moments that we have together are the, I think they're the bricks in a really strong relationship that we have.
Hi, my name is Nancy Ross Zimmerman. I'm living in Cincinnati, Ohio. In 1989, February 1st, my husband was killed in a car accident in Houston, Texas, where we were living. So there was no one, I thought, that would work with my children, you know, to come up with any kind of Mother's Day recognition. And it turned out that the church that we were a part of, my husband and I had been a part of a small group, and the other couples in that group had gotten together, and then without me knowing anything, they had pulled the kiddos out of Sunday school, taken them out into the lovely landscaped area around the church. The photographer had brought this little antique bench, and they just shot photos of the kids. The picture of the children was really, really funny because Ashley usually had pretty nice little clothes she would wear. And on this particular Sunday, obviously she had chosen her own dress. And it was sort of a la Shirley Temple, you know, where it's almost up to her, you know, top of her thigh. It was so short. And Rob, he had bed hair, you know, just that morning hair when it's sticking up all over your head. But even that made it more precious because it wasn't like I had groomed them and chosen the matching outfits, you know, that they would look really good on. It was just even more special because of the randomness and the sort of haphazard way they were put together that morning. You know, I had been feeling really sorry for myself for the previous 14 weeks being a single mom, and it was a wonderful affirmation that, you know, we're going to be okay, and it just felt like a burst of hope. I will never, ever forget that gift and those friends. We all need somebody
to lean on. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Cooper, and I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. Well, about 5 years ago in 2003, my husband and I flew into Georgetown to the Bahamas to meet some very good friends of ours on Mother's Day weekend. We were going to meet them on their sailboat, the Carpe Diem. We anchored out, and when I went to our V-berth that night, I remember the boat was gently rocking, and the water was lapping up against the side of the boat, and it felt to me like I was back in the womb, and it felt entirely safe and secure. As I was being rocked by the boat, I remembered my mother and the way she had rocked me once, and probably more than once. And I remembered the hours upon hours that I had spent rocking my three children, who are now grown. I guess I would say that Mother Ocean gave me the sweetest gift, and that was a cradled night of very sweet sleep and extremely good memories.
Thank you to everyone who wrote to us. We got many more emails and stories. You can find those and pictures of little Ashley and Robbie, the three girls, Barbara, Becky, Sam, and the Memory Bowl. Come visit us at weekendamerica.org. Ah, New York City in the springtime. You can stroll Central Park, ride the rides at Coney Island, and this weekend you can head down to the Lower East Side for some Jell-O wrestling. Yep, I said it. One Sunday a month, women of many, many backgrounds climb into an inflatable kiddie pool stacked on mattresses, and they take each other down in slippery gel. Reporter Anna Boyko-Wyrock is a regular in the ring.
I'm a Jell-O wrestler and proud of it. I know what you're thinking. But this is no Fort Lauderdale Girls Gone Wild. This is a place to dress up in costume and be a superhero. And the Jell-O? Well, that's to make sure we don't take ourselves too seriously. Amateur female Jell-O wrestling is my refuge from the real world. I'm a recent college graduate, and I constantly struggle to get ahead. But once a month, when I come to wrestle, I can let go of the daily grind and act like a kid again. The event takes place at Arlene's Grocery, a funky bar in Manhattan's Lower East Side.
Now we're going to do it again fast, and this time you're going to scream.
We learn stunts and safety techniques before the match. This event is as much performance as it is fighting. In the ring, we show off fake moves in between real ones. Like when I yell clothesline and hold my arm out, the other girl runs into it and knocks herself over. We'd let guys wrestle too, but they just don't get it. This is Jell-O Wrestling founder Dana Sterling.
I did once or twice let guys compete. But guys, it just, when one guy pushes another, the other pushes back harder. And it's harder, harder, harder. And it just very quickly it got serious. Like even in the Jell-O.
But we girls take care of each other. There's an unspoken code of conduct. Be safe, be silly, and cooperate. Or get out of the ring. Wrestlers come to compete for a few different reasons. Like two-time champion Melissa Melly, a.k.a. Strawberry Shortcake. She calls herself a BBW, or Big Beautiful Woman.
There I could be myself, I could let loose, and I could just be trampy and nobody cares.
Others, like Nina Jaffergy, or Fire Angel, wrestle to get out aggression.
My boyfriend complained that I'm roughhousing him too much and he doesn't like pillow fights. So I decided, okay, then I'm going to slap some girl around in Jell-O.
But me, I wrestle because I want to win. Tonight I'm Gal Friday, sort of a disgruntled office assistant in business casual. I wear a blue-collared shirt and tan skirt, perfect attire for filing or flipping. In real life, I'm also the office grunt, the assistant, the intern, always the worker bee, never the queen. But not today. Oh, no. Today, I'm the one giving orders. When I stand tall in that inflatable pool, ankle deep in warm Jell-O, I am the alpha female.
Dana is fighting back. She's and she pulls Gal Friday down.
In the first part of the tournament, I blow past contestants Frida Tortilla and Dana Sterling. It's tough, but I'm clawing my way to the top. Next, I face Data Crunch, a first-timer visiting from L.A.
You know what, Data Crunch? You better be ready because your system is going down.
Data Crunch throws off her floppy disks and rolls up her purple sleeves. An expert at running cables, she nails me good with a clothesline to the chest. I stagger to my feet and swing her around the ring by her long, dark braids. She puts up a fight, but I'm a skilled office assistant and well-versed in crunching data. I won the match, but I feel kind of sick. I've had more than my suggested serving of Jell-O. Finally, I fight a lush with a thing for fishnets and gold lamé.
I'm top shelf. I only drink the good stuff.
The tattoo on her arm reads fierce. She gnashes her teeth and flexes her muscles. But she can't scare me. I'm ready to go. I knock over top shelf, but she drags me down with her. Body slam! It hurts, but I lunge back. We lock arms in a huddle. We both gasp for breath. And then she asks, do you mind if I win? Do I mind? And give up so close to the top? but there's a desperate glimmer in her eye. She's asking me to win. And she's so polite. We do some more flips before I give in. The MC tries to resuscitate me.
Gal Friday! Gal Friday! Oh, wow.
Is this NPR or CPR?
I wanted to win so badly. But this event is about community. It's about taking care of your sister. It's not easy for me to accept defeat. But here at Amateur Female Jello Wrestling, it's cool to be a loser. Covered in Jello in New York City, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyra for Weekend America.
NPR, CPR, very, very nice. You can see Anna wrestling Strawberry Shortcake and more when you come see us at weekendamerica.org. This weekend is going to mean extra Jello for Anna because she's going to a family reunion. So it'll be wiggling on the plate. The New York Jello wrestlers might want to grapple indoors today. There's a good chance of showers there because you wouldn't want to get damp when you're Jello wrestling. With more weather and human folly, here's Weekend America's Brendan Noonan.
Painting the outdoors is hard. The tree bark ruins your brush, and no matter what you do, the grass is always greener. So instead, make a painting of the outdoors at Arizona's Tonto Natural Bridge State Park. Artists will gather at the park, depict nature, and then judge each other's work. For non-artists, it'll be as fun as watching paint dry, which won't take long since it'll be 78 degrees and sunny. Night owls party till they puke. Real owls puke so they can eat again. You see, owls can't chew, hence the Cough It Up Festival in Paris, Arkansas. Visitors are invited to dissect owl pellets to identify the bird's prey. If that doesn't make them woozy enough, it'll also be humid and 85 degrees. If you can't make it to the festival but you're still curious, next time you see an owl, just ask it to turn its head all the way around and cough. Might want to pop an aspirin before this one. Dardanelle, Arkansas hosts the 19th annual Yell Fest, which features a 5K run, an ugly dog contest, and yelling. When Week in Weather contacted the Dardanelle Chamber of Commerce for comment, they responded, "Ah!" 82 degrees and partly cloudy. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
When the sun rises every hour and a half, how do you start your day? Musical Mornings on the Space Shuttle, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is away. I'm Bill Radke. This weekend on the International Space Station, astronauts are grappling with robotic arms and preparing for a visit later this month from Space Shuttle Discovery. Every day that shuttle approaches, Discovery crew members will begin their mornings with a song. NASA Mission Control down in Houston awakens the astronauts with music that is specially picked out by the crew's friends and family. In this next installment of our Listening In series, producer Gideon D'Arcangelo asks some shuttle astronauts what they like to wake up to when they're orbiting the Earth.
This first portion of our show brought to you by Powder Milk Biscuits made from whole wheat that give shy persons strength to get up and do what needs to be done.
Good morning, Atlantis, and especially a great good morning to you today, Steve. It's a great day for rendezvous.
Hey, thanks very much, Shannon, and thanks very much to my wonderful wife, Jennifer, for a little Powder Milk Biscuit to wake up to in the morning. Our food's really healthy on over here, but we can still dream of some of the brown stains on the bag that indicate freshness.
As commander of the shuttle mission Atlantis, Steve Frick's special job was to dock with the International Space Station on Flight Day 3. So on that day, his wife Jennifer picked out a song for him.
I heard Powder Milk coming over the speakers, and sure enough, even though it was zero G, I was tapping my foot and big smile on my face. It was a great way to start the day.
Al Drew is one of the Capcom astronauts. They stay down in Houston and handle all communications between Mission Control and the shuttle.
The technical term for what I do is the planning shift Capcom. We work the overnight, and the very last thing I get to do is to wake up the crew. So my unofficial name for my job was being the wake-up morning DJ for the crew.
One of his jobs is to assemble the wake-up playlist with family and friends in the weeks leading up to the mission.
Just trying to make sure that it's there's a human flavor to the whole thing. So much of what we do is very technically driven, very schedule driven. To be able to give them just a sly wink over the airwaves is that's my chance to do that.
Alan Poindexter had his song played on entry day when he piloted the shuttle back into the atmosphere.
Good morning, Atlantis. And a special good morning to you today, Dex, and happy entry day.
We're really looking forward to entry day today and landing on the first rev at Kennedy Space Center. We're ready to get to work. Thanks for the music, and looking forward to a great day.
It was exciting to be able to hear that music on entry day, and my son picked that out. He and I both are musicians going way back, and he thought that was a fitting piece.
Hail to the Spirit of Liberty, John Philip Sousa's March, was a fitting soundtrack for Poindexter's scorching reentry into the atmosphere.
You initiate the entry by decelerating about 300 feet per second, just enough to drop out of orbit. And about somewhere over the middle of the Pacific, you are officially back in the atmosphere. The only thing that might be a little disconcerting is looking out the window when you see this orange glow enveloping the entire vehicle, which is, the air molecules being heated up into a plasma. But if you can keep from looking at that, then, it feels like a normal, smooth airplane ride.
The first wake-up song sent into space was Hello, Dolly in 1965.
The tradition that this goes back to actually was back to the days, I believe, from Gemini, when the folks from Mission Control would pick the most obnoxious song they could think of to go rouse the crew out of their sleep. It was just their Mission Control's way of poking the astronauts in the ribs, just a good-natured way to rouse them. And it's over the years evolved into something where the family and friends of the crew members pick something that helps out the crew.
Cheer up, sire. You know what they say.
What do they say, Patsy?
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble.
On his last day in orbit, Steve Frick got one more special song.
And always look on the bright side of life.
Good morning, Atlantis, and a special good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Shannon, and thanks very much to my wonderful wife, Jennifer, for that little touch of Monty Python in the morning.
Steve's a big Python fan. There's a lot of Python fans here in Houston. I was actually up late at night watching the wake-up music, and I could see a lot of heads bobbing and feet tapping in the Mission Control Center as they played that music.
As they circle the planet once every 90 minutes, the astronauts say the music is a thread that ties them back to their loved ones on Earth.
You know, until we're back on Earth safe, everyone at home that cares about you is going to be worrying. So that's always in the back of your mind. So when you have something like this play that's a special bond between, in this case, Jennifer and I, it just makes you feel a little bit better to know that that she's thinking about me, and she's probably sitting at home right then watching the music play, even though it's probably 3 o'clock in the morning or something in Houston. So it was a nice moment of connection in the midst of that the whirlwind that is a shuttle mission.
Always look on the bright side of life.
On Earth, I'm Gideon D'Arcangelo for Weekend America.
Always look on the light side of life.
This weekend, astronauts' loved ones are choosing the wake-up songs for the next shuttle mission, Discover, later this month. We asked you last week to tell us what songs you like to wake up to, and we have assembled the Weekend America Wake Up Listener Playlist just for you. Some fine, fine choices there at weekendamerica.org. And that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Come on! I'm Bill Radke. On the bright side of life, Desiree Cooper will be joining us again next week. And another bright silver lining, you can download a free podcast of this whole show at weekendamerica.org. It's your weekend. I hope you're enjoying it.
Forget about your seat. Give the audience a grin. Enjoy it. It's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
40 years ago, Richard Nixon found a clever way to win Republican votes.
The American political party that tends to win is usually the one that claims the mantle of populism. What Richard Nixon did was to create a language to make people feel that they could vote for Republicans and not be snobs.
On the next Weekend America, Nixon's 1968 Silent Setter speech and why it still matters today. Join us.